Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, hi everyone. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for having me, Bioculture, in this amazing panel and stream. And thank you, Lendl. There are, I think, quite a lot of connections between our papers. I too am looking at the infinite, and it's the infinite is playing as a background to my papers. This is sound from long players, sound artwork by Jem Feiner that I'll be talking about a little bit, as a vehicle to other things. So I'll just read it out. So it's about abstract audio, as you can hear. In a small lighthouse in London's Docklands, overlooking the unimpressive Millennium Dome, sits a 1,000-year-long digital sound artwork called Long Player, made by Expogues member Jem Feiner. The raw material for the piece consists in 20 minutes of inharmonic Tibetan singing bowls, time-stretched in Super Collider to create an extremely lengthy, barely audible, well, it's really audible now, but it's not, it doesn't feel like that when you're there, I promise, loop that will play without repetition for 1,000 years. Long Player began its extensive life on the 1st of January 2000, marking the beginning of the new millennium, and will continue to play until 2999. It seems that the 21st century began with an unusual abstract audio event. Yeah, maybe. Unusual as it is part of an unexpected turn towards the sonic, in this case as the chosen medium with which to announce the arrival of the digital at the dawn of the new century. Part musical score, part art installation, Long Player was created, according to Feiner, quote, from instant to instant by a simple system operating upon a piece of musical raw material. Its long durational score provides an alternative computational paradigm for digital sound design. Its compositional value rests on an endless, non-linear iteration of sonic matter that will only loop after 1,000 years have passed, at which point it will complete its cycle and begin again. In this way, the project marks a passage from the mere technological organization of music as the finite accumulation of bits to the uncertainty and openness of cosmic sound. The anti-teleology of the system means that it will keep on playing endlessly, continuously reconfiguring new rhythmic planes out of the digital landscape that it inhabits. According to Kojo Eshin, Long Player is an event disguised as music, concurrently subsisting as, and this is Kojo, historicizing engine, abstract machine, and unidentified audio event. It is an installation heralded as a digital triumph for the new millennium at the same time as it actualizes the limits of the digital, announcing its death in the future, since the system will probably go on to live well beyond the digital computer era. Its impact lies in its affective qualities as a sonic event rather than in any particular music technology. Long Player's millennial triumph is a fitting example of how the sonic underdog and its subcultures gain center stage in the media, arts, and humanities. Particularly during the last decade or so, artists and theorists have programmed, performed, manipulated, and philosophized the sounds of media technologies. This emerging audio culture echoes an attempt to resist the tyranny of ocular centrism and to redefine sound according to an extra-musical understanding of its materiality. Yet this resurgence of the auditory and inclusion of sound in cultural, artistic, and theoretical contexts, both inside and outside academia, is often in danger of fetishizing the sonic and reiterating its ideological separation from the visual. Romanticizing sound goes against what Jonathan Stern warns us is another little piece of the vibrating world. Although experimenting with the sonic has enabled the consideration of new models of knowledge and experience, this paper suggests that there is room for extending the experiment further. When all talk of chance, control, intentionality, deep listening, and so on and so forth subsides, what lies dormant in the silence? What else might emerge from the entanglements of the sound, art, technology ensemble that does not belong to a body as a quality or asset and is not tied to a plane of action or attached to anything else outside itself? The sonic, especially as it is manifested in current media arts practice, indicates that there may be other approaches to time and space. But these risks remain hidden in the gaps around the actual knowable sphere of sound. A gap is not understood here as an empty vacuum, but rather as what allows the as yet unknown zones of perception, feeling, and experience to emerge. It is this gap that my paper and current work aspires to occupy in its attempt to consider an alternative abstract dimension of sound that it terms rhythmic. The concept of rhythm, detached from symmetry and this idea of counting linearly from one to many, can uncover heterogeneous encounters between the different elements that it engages, affective processes that are irreducible to units and hierarchies, such as the subordination of time to space. Affect, according to Brian Massumi, suggests an emptying of perception from conscious, cognized activity, pointing to the ability of a body to feel in a vaguely sentient manner. Unlike emotion, affect is unqualified and non-subjective, a felt thought or thinking feeling, something that impinges upon a body too quickly to appear to have happened at all. Considering sound art vis-à-vis rhythm's affective qualities opens up the sonic event to assemblages of sensation that are independent of the space, time, and bodies that experience it. I follow Deleuze in understanding sensation to be, quote, that which is transmitted directly and avoids the detour and boredom of conveying a story. He's actually quoting Valéry here. In other words, sensation is an immediate visceral feeling, enlarging perception of the event without belonging to a perceiving subject. Rhythm probes the unintentional, unnameable, and unknowable forces residing between actual moments, solid structures, specific peoples, and events. Engaging with the concept introduces an uncertain logic to our dealings with time and to our relationship with the world. It is a venture that requires facing the unfamiliar yet real zones of the event. That is, it requires conceiving a rhythmicity of the event, where rhythm is not only a concept, but also a method with which to account for how the new comes to be. I'm sorry, there's a lot of rhythm in this paper. My rhythm analytic approach is concerned with uncovering the underlying tendencies, the affective and latent forces that accompany the event, but do not necessarily emerge in actuality. It's a difficult task. In other words, as my proposition goes, rhythm may be one way humans have of accessing the subsistence of a more ghostly or subterranean temporality lurking in the shadows of the sonic artwork. Experimental projects like Long Player, which digital technology practically enables and conceptually encourages, often demonstrate that in our relationship with computational art, chronology is in constant state of disruption. New media artworks that have a close affinity with the sonic can expose our human timescales to a time that is not ours, is no longer, or does not yet exist. In so doing, these experiments can help uncover the not taken for granted dimension of experience. This fleeting moment we can barely perceive with the senses, endure in consciousness or express through language, but which is vibrantly real in its effects. This is the elusive side of the sonic artwork. its rhythmicity, as rhythm, according to Nietzsche, is precarious, inconceivable, quote, at once sensuous and abstract, unquote. For Nietzsche, what is seen or heard when rhythm carves up time and supervenes on its objects is not rhythm per se, but structures of relation, tension and sensation at the boundary of the bodies that are made rhythmic. I lost it. Rhythm is the boundary that always remains external, in between, virtual, never fully owned by sensory perception and measure time at the larger scale. Plugged into this alien rhythm analysis, enduring ideas of time as a line always running forward and of form as a stable, permanent object are challenged and resisted. Rhythm makes way for the emergence of the more turbulent orders of spatiotemporality, as, in its Nietzschean schema, it is in fact the virtuoso of the irregular tempo of absolute or pure becoming. This power of rhythm to indicate unpredictable change is, I think, vigorously and viscerally expressed in the sonic work of art. In Feeling and Form, Susan Langer draws on the idea that art makes space and time appear that was not there before, endowing it with a richness, elasticity, and freedom of creation, most intensely expressed by the musical arts for Langer. As she explains, the tyranny of the one-dimensional scientific version of time is unmasked by an audible and sensible temporality, intrinsic to sonic events. The latter create an image of time different from the sequential one we normally assign to it. Langer calls this a virtual time or semblance. Pure sonic duration, she explains, creates a directly lived, quote, experiential time, measurable only in terms of sensibilities and tensions. That is what she calls a life of feeling. In Langer's philosophy, the main principle of the vital activity of all feeling is rhythm, whose purpose and significance has been consistently misunderstood as the mere regular recurrence of events. Rhythms, for Langer, quote, compose the dynamic pattern of feeling. It is this pattern that only non-discursive symbolic forms can present, and that is the point and purpose of artistic construction. Her concept of rhythm is useful to demonstrate that aesthetic forms are not static, but assemblages of tension and becoming, accumulating incessantly without reaching an end or resolution. Following this trail, I propose that we can theorize rhythm as liberated from the limits of symmetry, linearity, and regularity by plugging it into the force of the artwork. As such, the concept helps plant the seeds for developing a speculative aesthetic theory that has the power to explain and put into practice some of the most basic concepts of science and philosophy, such as time, perception, and event. A rhythmic ontogenetics of this kind traces sound art as one power able to contain a lingering moment of unpredictable form, unspecified feeling, and pre-subjective becoming. This moment holds neither the present nor the presence of the human, and says nothing about the intention of the artist or the philosopher. Rather, it is transitory flash that may or may not emerge to perception. And you see, it stopped emerging to perception, conveniently. A feeling that outlives the space-time and bodies that make up and experience it. Returning to our opening example, long player seems to indicate a layer of time not necessarily experienced within the actual domain of the project, yet accompanying it. Although sensory perception is not muted, an audible sound addresses the aware zones of a body. Connecting to long player creates a feeling of something else occurring beyond what one can hear or recognize. The event lives in paradox. Here is a sound art project that is built in digital code but will endure for 1,000 years. Its visitors are experiencing the intensity of the outcome of pulling together a collectivity of discrete instances and stretching them to infinity. The artwork is aesthetically intriguing owing to its setup, location, and effect, but doubles up as a thought experiment that brings together smooth longevity and instant shock. Long Player is a piece that both marks the break of the new millennium and lives on beyond the shock of that millennial turn. It is simultaneously a computational machine of precise calculation and an abstract machine of serene ambience. Absolute duration intertwined with mathematical precision. The concomitant experience of an event in which many things happen, such as a population of instances of microsonic turbulences, yet almost nothing emerges to perception. Long Player as an abstract audio or rhythmic event demonstrates that art does not merely account for what is given, known, and consciously apprehended. Rather, it is preoccupied with intervening on unfamiliar, non-sensuous processes out of which something felt emerges. Sonic art, in this case, exposes a rhythmicity immanent to aesthetic experience, enabling us to twist and rethink time outside the tyranny of the ticking clock. In Long Player, time is felt affectively rather than as a chronological arrangement of events, and the moment is never fully exhausted in the here and now of human awareness. Operating at the margins of perception, the sonic artwork becomes a rhythm machine of the future, summoning and expressing an unknown sense of time and acting as indicator of events yet to come.
Questions?
I have a question.
No.
Thanks, this is really brilliant. Super interesting. I'm just wondering about if the opposite can also be the case with this piece. I'm thinking about the way, for people who don't know the piece, he spends a fair bit of time contingency planning for, you know, moments of upgrade between technologies. It can be performed non-digitally for a fairly extended period of time in order to, you know, upgrade the servers or migrate it from SuperCollider to another software, that sort of thing. And so I take your point. I think it's absolutely true that there's this sort of a feeling of a kind of extended temporality that we, or an affect of extended temporality that enters there. But I also wonder, is it all at the same time a kind of hyper-clock time where these extended temporalities are conceivable, which would be inconceivable orally, inconceivable even in a kind of any understanding of a clock,
sure,
but become actually conceivable precisely because they're laid out in a static notational plan that seems to account for material and technical contingencies? And I just wondered if you could maybe talk a little bit about those relationships between the necessities of the work.
Yeah, absolutely. I was hoping it wasn't going to become about Long Play.
I'm sorry.
No, not at all. It's just my portal to saying what I did, you know, to kind of theorizing a more abstract idea of audio. But you're right, and it's a good point. And I think Jim Finer, were he here, I usually see him at kind of sonic things, but I thought he might be here and disagree completely with everything I say, would agree with you, because it is also, in a way, kind of, first of all, yeah, he plans exactly quite a lot in terms of what will happen to it, because it's such a long durational piece that technology will change a million times until, you know, it stops to run. And secondly, it does work this, and I think affect works in a double way
yeah,
as well. And exactly why that's a good point, because on the one hand, for me, it allows me to kind of conceive or engineer concepts. Lendl was talking about, you know, engineer ideas, as I said, as a portal to these things. And the sonic, that's how it works for me. And sonic artwork and sonic theory, that's exactly how. It works for me in order to go kind of, you know, a bit beyond it. But at the same time, it also makes felt and makes perceptible things that we weren't perhaps able to theorize. And art does that, and it works as a in affect works in a double way. So I think it's a good point. But you made the point.
Do you see those as in tension with one another, or those? Is it? Maybe you answered it there by saying that affect works always in that doubled way, and so.
Yeah.
So they're not in tension. They're kind of co-productive.
Co-productive?
Yeah.
How do you mean?
In the sense that affect requires this sort of.
I don't think it's a there is a risk running there for like theorizing the opposite, the opposition, or you know, or theorizing a dichotomy between them. And I think affect, at least in according to Brian Sewin, you know, how I, because there are many theories of affect. Works against opposition. So this kind of multi-dimensionality that I was trying to pick up on affect would include that, what you mentioned, but not as a binary opposite, not as a kind of this or that, or this and that, not as only a two-way option, I suppose, but also, but definitely as an option. At least it allows me to consider it. Does that kind of make sense?
Yes. Just very briefly, before we let go of that particular work, I think it's perhaps just worth noting that the piece certainly existed in Jem Feiner's mind quite independently of its digital realization.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certainly quite serious discussions in 1999 about, a kind of mechanical version of the piece,
mm-hmm.
rather than a digital, a kind of vaguely clock-like entity that would have performed the piece.
Yeah. I think Brian Eno went on to do something like that, didn't he? And also Jem Feiner went on to kind of go out and argue completely against the digital and then do his second work, which was a score for A Hole in the Ground, which was completely analog. And So I don't know if it came across that I'm kind of bigging up the digital for allowing, but I think I mentioned in my paper that digitality, on the one hand, for me, is interesting. My work looks at digital media art and its affinity with the sonic and what else it can do. But at the same time, I mentioned in the paper that although digitality allows us to conceive and practically enables this piece, even the idea of the piece, despite what it will go on to do, Super Collider, the way he was able to stretch these bits to infinity without them ever looping, which wouldn't have been done in that way prior to digitality, is not a matter of kind of evolution or progression or technological progression. That is, I'm not trying to suggest that it brings on some sort of kind of perfection or elegance that it was not possible with analog technologies before. Just a note. Quite the contrary.
Mike?
Thanks very much. So I wanted to try and get a grip on, so one of the ideas was that these kinds of pieces can help us experience temporalities or new temporalities, right? Is that, that was one of the ideas? Okay, I don't want to misquote you. So I'm not even quoting or misrepresenting you. So say I'm sitting listening to Long Player, right? So I just want to try and get the idea of what's going on in my kind of my phenomenological aspect, right? So. Okay, well, but I mean, it seems important because I'm talking about experiencing temporalities, right? I mean, so, so I sit and listen, and let's say I take out all my other kind of sensory inputs, let's say I have no other way of indexing time, right? In what, you know, there's not a clock there, or there's not a beep that goes off for 5 minutes or something. And I sit and listen, and I take it that one of the ideas is that if we think about music, the way like music is put together, like songs, you know, verse, chorus, middle, eight, out, right, something like this. Like that helps you index it in a linear way, right?
Yeah.
So then, is the idea here that there's so little to grasp onto, with in terms of structure, with what we're hearing, right? That I can't order things in any particular manner when I'm listening, such that, that's the first question: whether that's the kind of thing that's going on. So is it a lack of kind of information as recognizable, which lets me individuate events and then put them in a certain order.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question, if that's the case, then is this a different temporality or am I just not experiencing time anymore? Because, I mean, you might just think time is thinking about events in order, right? So am I now just kind of going out of time? That question is kind of underpinned by my worries that I don't know what it would be to have a different temporality other than what I get, right?
Yeah.
Unless it's just a...
That's a good question. And we can discuss it for
right,
hours,
sure, yeah.
Actually, because there are many things in what you just mentioned. Like one is, first of all, yes, part of it, the non-linearity, openness, this endlessness, the non-structure of the piece, and so on, that makes it a kind of more abstract audio experience, is definitely important to it and to me, and why I, you know, chose to talk about it. So yes, but it's not the only thing. It's not. It kind of, if you think about it as kind of pockets of relation, say that you have, you know, the musical sphere, of course, and then you have kind of sound, which is not exactly the same, you know, the sonic sphere is not exactly the same as music, because music is kind of organized sound, right? But there's a lot more to sound to it, that like you mentioned, non-linear, non-structural, and so on. And then what I'm trying to get to is kind of this other, you know, so you say if it's like music and sound, and then this kind of smaller diagram, sketches, this kind of more unsound or rhythmic playing of thought. So music and sound, and the fact that that it is audible, even though it's non-linear and so on, is an entry point to it, but it stops being what you, kind of the sensory side of it stops being important. And there you have this idea of time that can be, you know, what you I think hint at, which is this timelessness, what you talk about, this timeless quality. And I think yeah, so whether it's a new temporality, well, it is a new temporality, because it's kind of an unfelt non-hierarchical, not kind of to do with special temporal coordinates as we know them, the tyranny of the clock that I mentioned. So it is a new temporality,
yeah, sure.
In that, but it's a timelessness. For example, I talked about, I also wrote something recently about timelessness as a quality experience in another media, sonic media artwork. So it is a kind of timelessness. Yeah, it is.
Sure, okay. So I guess maybe I was going...
You know, time stops. Like I mentioned, the fact that time stops kind of halts this idea that art, the experience of the artwork makes time stop in a sense. Nietzsche talks about rhythm in that sense. And he says, or about art in his writings of rhythm in this sense. And he says that it kind of allows this frozen moment where you can kind of glimpse the whole of time at once. So it is a kind of timelessness, but...
So I just wondering whether it would help you
point
with David's concern, right? So if you differentiate between subject and object here, right? So the question is the new temporality...
What subjects
and
objects?
Me, subject, object, long play. Okay, the piece of, the thing that's playing, right?
Oh dear.
The thing I'm listening to. I'm going to talk about it again, right? So one of the concerns is about linearity within the piece, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to put in these, in order to deal with the practicalities, you've got to pre-plan some stuff, something like that, you know, put some linearity in it. But, I mean, if I don't know about the linearity, I don't know all the pre-planned bits. I don't know whether it matters so much. You mean from the subject's perspective, it might still have the same effect or affect on me. I think I was confused because you were talking about mostly about the objects, and I think I've just hooked on to the subject. Yeah, right.
I think it's
important.
Not so much about the subject. There is this problem there of trying to theorize these things, because I think I also mentioned this in the paper. Technologies are there, heard things, sense things are there, subjects are there, and objects, if you want to differentiate in that way, or if you want to bring in phenomenological
ideas. I think you mentioned it though.
Ideas.
Preceding subject.
Are there. Yeah, but I mentioned it, but in what context? That's important, right?
Okay, sure.
They're still there, but I think the importance of it is that it, for me, is that it's not about the perceiving. It's not about the perceiving subject anymore. The problem is the problem of language as well. So how do you know, I'm sitting here talking about this, using, like, it's always the case with these things, these speculative things. But it's not about the subject, because that's a problematic distinction, I think, between the subject. Now, if you talk about affective qualities and assemblages, not, I don't know how familiar you might be with this work, but the a differentiation between subject and objects is kind of it becomes invalid.
Okay.
But maybe we can talk about this over lunch or something, because it might be a long talk to try.
Okay.
There's one more question here.
Regarding rhythm and this question of how important is it to maybe the relationship between rhythm and this sonic environment, because I sense that there is something in rhythm which traverses these different separate distinct fields of visual, architectural, sonic, and so on. So this perspective from the sonic and the relationship between rhythm, how important is it when you think about this and theorize it to retain a certain affinity to the sonic and then to open it up maybe, or how do you see this?
Good, you guys are great. The sonic is, for me, the sonic is important. This is what I was talking about, you know, kind of musical, the sonic, the rhythmic, as in the unsound. It is important because there is an obvious relation between rhythm and music and sound anyway, although I'm trying to kind of stretch it and challenge it. It's there, which was my starting point. Sonic artworks and sonic events do something, that's what I mentioned, to our experience of time and or our knowledge of time and ideas that I find very interesting. So that's my attraction to them. That's why these guys let me talk here, I think. But it's not just about the sonic, and that's true. For example, Susan Langer is talking about rhythm in design. She's talking about how design is rhythm, non-symmetrical. Not kind of a symmetrical idea of design, non-symmetrical. She's talking about rhythm as the substance of all feeling and of life. So it's not only about the sonic, and there are many, and I'm interested in how it's not only about the sonic. Watch this space with Mark. We're going to do more stuff about that and how it kind of stretches out into other dimensions and into other fields. So yeah, definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.